It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, television streaming passed cable and broadcast in viewership for the first time last month. What does that mean for the stuff we watch and what we pay for it? Join the conversation and share your streaming habits, if any. First, the U.S. ranks behind dozens of other countries in literacy. One in six American adults has low literacy skills. In Wisconsin, about 7% of the population has low literacy. There's a lot that goes into that, and our next guest says a big part of the solution can happen long before kids even start school. In her new book, she shares advice to help kids get ready for reading starting at age zero. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How did you learn how to read at an early age? How do you help your kids? Do you have questions about what you can do to build literacy skills at early ages? If you teach in preschool education or kindergarten, first grade, what thoughts do you have for parents out there on getting kids ready for reading? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Maya Payne Smart is Milwaukee-based literacy advocate and affiliated faculty in educational policy and leadership in the College of Education at Marquette University. Her new book is called Reading for Our Lives, a literacy action plan from birth to six. Maya, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
To start with, you're kind of sounding the alarm on the importance of starting on literacy way before school starts. Tell us why that's so important.
It's so important for parents and educators and everyone really in our community to start thinking about reading with infants and toddlers, because so much brain development happens in those early years, and so much of the groundwork that supports future reading success happens long before kids can make sense of text on a page.
How much difference does it make for that kid, say they're just hitting kindergarten, how much difference does it make to have a background in some of this pre-literacy learning that they might get from their parents or from a childcare center?
It makes a huge difference. There are numerous studies that document a positive correlation between things like the number of letter names that a child knows at kindergarten entry and their reading ability down the road, because all of these skills kind of build on one another. And so the vocabulary that parents can introduce first orally, language development supports literacy development down the road. But all of those words that parents are speaking to kids, whether reading a book or just engaging in conversation in everyday life, contributes to the words that they'll be able to recognize and print down the road. And then there are so many other skills, the ability to discern sounds within words or the ability to recognize different letter shapes. All of those things contribute to reading down the road. And so it's important for parents to have an understanding of how it unfolds over time.
We'll dig into a lot of the practical advice you give in the book. One more point I want to get to before we do that is, yeah, it's been a day or two since my kids were that little. But I remember, you know, when I'd read to them, I'd like, great, this is the magic ingredient. Reading to them is going to do it. Reading your book, reading to kids is great, but we need a little more. Why isn't just reading to them going to do the job?
I think many parents are in the same boat that you were in, where you think of the book as this magical device and also this magical experience with your child. So it's just important to remember that it's really about you and the child and the relationship and that dynamic exchange back and forth with them. So the book is important to the extent that it prompts conversation and to the extent that they're paying attention to some of the print on the page. But the magic is really in that relationship. And so I, in the book, devote two chapters actually to the power of conversation and talk, just to really emphasize that point to parents, that it's not just about the words that we're saying, whether we're speaking aloud or narrating what we're doing during the day. It's about that turn-taking, the back and forth, serve and return duet of conversation with the child. And when we ask questions, it gives them a chance to formulate responses and, again, build those brain connections that are so important down the road.
Talking to Maya Payne Smart about her new book. It's called Reading for Our Lives, a literacy action plan from birth to six, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Were there things you did to encourage literacy, maybe for your own kids in that preschool era? Do you have questions for our guest? Are you a new parent? Maybe need some advice. I know I did. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. And Maya, yeah, when I saw age, you know, from birth to six, I thought, well, wait, how can kids be reading at birth? Well, they can't. But you were just talking about that idea of modeling conversation, a back and forth between a parent and a kid before that kid can even talk. Could you spell out how that works?
Absolutely. So it's important for parents to recognize all of the attempts at communication that their infant is making. So while your three-month-old isn't going to respond in words or sentences, they will give you coos and babbles that indicate their engagement and indicate their learning. So if we treat those babbles as conversation or respond to those and ask questions and just proceed as if it's a typical conversation with words, we're creating so many wonderful learning opportunities for that child. And I think it's also important for parents to recognize that when the littlest babies are slapping at the book or chewing it, throwing it, all of that is important exposure to books, but also important sensory learning for the child. So don't discount that.
And speaking of those books, me reading to a kid, great. Letting the kid interact, you say, is really the key. Talk about ways we can do that starting at an early age.
Kids are learning when they're interested in paying attention and engaged. So hearing the story, they're going to pick up wonderful vocabulary and knowledge and background information. When they're older, let's say 3 or 4, and they start to pay attention to the print, and you're dragging your finger from left to right, that's teaching them something about print, or you're showing that the text moves from left to right or top to bottom of the page. There are just so many lessons within the book objects. But again, the parent brings the lesson alive by paying attention to the child, noticing what they're interested in, and responding with words and gestures.
And so it can be things like point at the dog or help me turn the page or whatever is age appropriate, right?
Absolutely. And the age appropriate piece is so important because there's so much growth and development that happens from birth, which is why I started the book mentioning from birth all the way to 6 years, because learning does look different at different ages. That 12 to 14 month old may be pointing to familiar characters or objects in the book, or they might point to things that they want you to name. They may be beginning to hold a crayon and make marks, the beginning of writing. So when parents have a little more knowledge about what's going on developmentally with children, they're better able to help the child get to the next level. And to your point earlier, we're not advocating that babies can read, but we are saying that parents can nurture future reading through this type of engagement.
One big theme in your book, I think parents might hear this and think, oh my God, I'm already trying to feed my kids and make sure their sheets are clean and whatever, and to have a job and things like that. I can't do hour-long reading lessons every day too. A lot of the stuff, so much of the stuff you're talking about is stuff we can work in to our daily routines, right?
Yes. And there are so many opportunities in the day to build these things in when the child is waking up or at a mealtime or bedtime or bath time or any of those routine moments. All of those everyday occurrences can be reminders to engage around language. One of my favorite examples is, I talk in the book about phonemic awareness, which is building awareness of the sounds within words. And I talk about how to do that with nursery rhymes and songs and wordplay and different things. And one parent, as a reminder to sing nursery rhymes, got a changing pad for their diaper changing station that had nursery rhyme imagery printed on it. And so it was just couldn't be a more timely reminder. So we often think of reminders on our calendars and clocks and things like that. But those physical reminders in the space where you're engaging in something with your child every day anyway are great opportunities to teach in a fun, playful way.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Susan is with us in Madison. Susan, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask
Hello.
About Susan?
Hi. I'm a grandparent of a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old toddlers, and my daughter is career-minded, and her husband is too. They got busy lives. I want to support them. I want to help the grandkids out learning literacy and that. I can buy them books. I can buy them gifts for reading and that, but it may sit there. Do you have any tips on grandparents, how they can support this lifestyle?
Grandparents. Absolutely. Grandparents are so critical. Both of my daughter's grandmothers have played a major role in her literacy development. Even to this day, she's now entering fifth grade and is in a book club with one of her grandmothers. So grandparents, we encourage you to get involved as much as you can. But you can teach vocabulary as well, just in your conversations with the little ones and labeling and pointing and asking questions and being sure to keep the conversation going and giving them opportunities to respond, and all of that grandparents can do. And you can also teach some of these lessons. You mentioned your grandchildren were 3 to 4 years old. That's prime time to start bringing their attention to print. Many parents don't realize that often when you're reading picture books with kids, they think the story comes from the pictures. They're not always aware that the story lies in those black marks on the page. But even without a book in hand, if there's a stop sign or words on a graphic t-shirt, whatever print is in their environment, you can teach little lessons by just describing that those letters are all made of lines, dots, and curves, and saying, oh, look at that A, it's made with 3 lines, 2 long ones that go this way and this way, and you know, trace the short one in the middle. But that talking about letters and print, naming them, getting them to pay attention to those shapes, all of that really contributes.
Susan, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Maya Smart about her new book, Reading for Our Lives, with advice on building literacy skills for kids even before they go to school. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you remember learning to read? Were there key things that you think helped you along the way, or that you had trouble with along the way as a parent or grandparent? How have you worked to try to help your kids get ready to learn to read? Or do you have questions for our guest on how to do this stuff? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with literacy advocate Maya Smart about her new book, Reading for Our Lives, a literacy action plan from birth to 6. You can join in with your experiences or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Christina is with us in Glenwood City. Christina, hi.
Hi there. Thank you. Well, I have been sending colorful cards to my 4-year-old niece ever since she was little. I write a detailed message. She has kept all of those cards, and she'll take them out, and she will read stories. She'll make up stories about what I've said, or she'll look at the colors of the cards or the animals, and she will just talk about what's going on in the card. And that has really kept us connected with each other. And I think it's made her very articulate.
I love it, Christina. Thank you so much. Maya, that fits into a lot of things you talk about in your book, including community, connection with other people as being something that helps develop literacy.
Absolutely. Parents are stressed and starved for time and dealing with a lot of different things. So when you recognize that you don't have to do it all on your own, that you can rely on your network, your relatives, your neighbors and friends, librarians, pediatricians, and this bigger and bigger universe of people who are all supporting your child as a reader, it makes things easier. But connection, communication, all of those things that engage the child and get them interested in print and reading and writing, it's all wonderful.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Tom joins us now in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Your guest has spoken of talking with a child or reading to a child, but I wonder where does someone or a family comes from a culture of an oral tradition of telling stories? Where does that fit in?
Well, interesting. Tom, thanks. Maya, any thoughts on that?
Yes, an excellent question. And oral storytelling and those rich family and cultural traditions are so wonderful, and they also contribute to reading success. We just have to be clear on the contribution they make. So obviously they make contributions to that child's vocabulary and their cognitive skills, critical thinking, social connection. But what they're not going to get from oral storytelling is that familiarity with print. So they're not going to learn that text moves from left to right and top to bottom of the page. They aren't going to gain familiarity with recognizing the letters in print. So continue with the storytelling, absolutely, and know that it has value and is wonderful and contributes to their ability to understand what they read down the road, and also just to have all of this rich vocabulary and background knowledge to build upon, but know that they also need print awareness, which can come from books or, as I mentioned earlier, text that appears on cereal boxes or t-shirts or in other contexts.
Tom, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Maya Smart about her book, Reading for Our Lives, A Literacy Action Plan from Birth to Six. Maya, before we go back to our callers, I wanted to get your advice for, say there's somebody out there listening, they're a parent, and they're thinking, hey, I never developed good literacy skills myself. I'm not a strong reader, maybe even a little intimidated by it. Do you have advice for them on how to help their kids out anyway?
The main advice is to play to your strengths and be confident in knowing that the conversation that you have, listening to them, responding to their coos and babbles, and other communication as they get older, all of that is valuable and supports reading and literacy as well. And then even when it comes to teaching specific literacy skills or building their awareness of letters and print, most parents, even if they aren't tremendous readers themselves, know more letters than that three-year-old or that four-year-old. So you can lean into what you do know and be sure to share that. And then you can also look to your community and support, maybe story time through librarians for them to get even more exposure to language and opportunities to get familiar with books. And talking to your pediatrician about those developmental milestones and how they're tracking and where they're going and where there might be opportunities to bring in specialists or other support. So definitely do what you can, do it with confidence, do it with joy, make it playful, songs, games, all of that is wonderful.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Juanita is with us in Fitchburg. Juanita, hi.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234.
I'm hearing Juanita's radio. I guess Juanita wanted to mention using music to help words come to life. That sounds great. Let's go to Susie now in New Berlin. Susie, hi.
Hi. I was going to mention when my kids were little, we used to play the alphabet game while we were in the car. Whether we were in the, out in the country or in the city, they had to find the letters of the alphabet. We wanted to see, especially in town, how fast we could go through the whole alphabet. So they had to look at the signs outside and find A and then B and then sure. C and then, through all the way, obviously all the way through. Also just reminding them that, we read for a lot of reasons, not just in books,
Great. Susie, thanks a lot for sharing that. Yeah, I think the story is I learned my first letter was a letter K because to drive anywhere from where I was, you had to go by the Kmart. And there was a big
yes.
K. But Susie, that's a great example, Maya, of the kind of things we can do, again, without even cracking a book open.
Absolutely. Those everyday opportunities that are fun and enjoyable. So if it's a game, don't think that it's not teaching or that they aren't learning, because they absolutely are. And the more fun and engaging it is, the more time they're going to spend on task building that letter knowledge in that case. But songs, all of that is wonderful. I met someone over the weekend whose son was deemed the king of kindergarten at his school because of his strong reading when he entered school. And the mom explained that he learned it because they had a karaoke business. And he spent a lot of time watching people sing while seeing the text that they were singing, each word light up as they sang it. And so it wasn't with a book in hand, but it was still making that print sounds connection.
Excellent. Thanks for that call. I learned the rest of the alphabet, by the way, from baseball cards, the numbers too. Back to your calls now. Barb is with us in Winneconne. Barb, hello.
Hello. I'm a retired reading specialist. It's been 20 years already since I've been out, but it brought a big smile to my face when I heard Maya talk about her advice, because it hasn't changed in 30 years. It's the same things that we've been telling parents for a long time, so I'm so happy that that's what the message still is. And as far as the grandparents, the biggest reason I probably became a voracious reader was my grandmother. My grandma always had a stack of books next to her chair, and she would read that stack of books. Every week, my aunt would go to the library and look for a new stack of books for her to read, and she was having trouble finding new mysteries that Grandma hadn't read yet. But it made a big impression on me because I saw Grandma read, but I also saw Grandma really enjoy that reading.
Gotcha, Barb. Thanks for the call. Maya, the idea of modeling reading for our kids, do as I do, in addition to do as I say.
I think that that's part of it. And I know my daughter learns a lot about how much we value reading from the amount of time that she sees her grandmothers and parents reading. But watching us read doesn't necessarily teach her anything. So that's why I wanted in the book to really break down those foundational skills so parents can teach with more intention in daily life. And as the caller mentioned, they are classics. Like, they're the things that it takes to become a reader are the same things that it took 30 years ago. Vocabulary, the sound awareness, print awareness, letter knowledge, making those letter sound connections. So those are all classics, and parents can benefit from just thinking about them and intentionally inserting those opportunities to teach them.
Thanks a lot for that call. Just 30 seconds or so left. Maya, can you leave us with maybe some resources for more, apart from your book, of course, where people can find more info?
Yes, I encourage parents to take a look at developmental milestones, particularly with the younger kids, so that you are tuned into how much they're growing and developing. And it just keeps in your mind this sense of progress and boosts your curiosity and interest and attention to what they're doing so that you can respond and keep conversation going and ask questions, label and point, and all of those things that we discussed earlier. You really are your child's first teacher, and you can become their best teacher when you become more intentional about it.
Maya, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Maya Payne Smart, a Milwaukee-based literacy advocate. We talked to her about her new book. It's called Reading for Our Lives, a literacy action plan from birth to six. If you still have a story to share about how you learned to read or helped someone else learn, you can still do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, streaming TV is on the rise, passing both cable and TV, broadcast TV last month. We'll talk to a TV writer about the competition in the industry, what it means for us as people who like to watch stuff sometimes. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Television viewing habits have been changing steadily over the last decade plus. Last month, they reached a new milestone, even before the release of a new Game of Thrones show. The Nielsen Company released data for July that showed, for the first time, streaming beat out broadcast TV and it beat out cable TV. The ratings company noted that the month of July has limited options for live sports, which tends to be a bigger draw for traditional TV channels. Instead, viewers spent nearly 18 billion minutes watching Stranger Things on Netflix. The shift to streaming has created tight competition between content platforms. It's left broadcast and cable trying to figure out how to keep up, and viewers trying to figure out how many different services they want to pay for. You could join in at 800-642-1234 to the extent that you watch stuff on a TV. How much do you watch regular television versus streaming? Have you cut the cord on cable or satellite TV? How many streaming services do you subscribe to? How does your streaming bill compare to what your cable bill would be? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Oh, it's something I'm really curious about. Has there ever been a show where you're like, I really got to watch that, and I have to subscribe to this new service to do it? Did you do it? 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@wpr.org. Allison Herman is a staff writer for The Ringer, where she writes about television and culture. Allison, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, we saw this tipping point. Streaming beat out both broadcast and it beat out cable in the same month. For the first time ever, it beat out both of them. I don't know. Does this mean something, or does this just kind of confirm something we knew all along? Streaming is getting bigger.
I think it coalesces something that has been a long-running trend ever since, you know, Netflix started streaming and then started making original series. We've been drifting this way for a while, but this is a big milestone for sure.
Now, you'd think, okay, more people are streaming, so it's a license to print money, but hang on. Netflix having some financial trouble, rethinking how they do things, other streaming services. What's going on in the industry?
Well, it almost depends on what you're talking about. So Netflix, ironically, is actually pretty profitable as far as streaming services go. But their big hiccup is that they've stopped growing as exponentially as they used to. And that's freaked out investors on Wall Street who kind of thought that the sky's the limit as far as streaming becoming the new TV. So in particularly in the United States and North America, a lot of these streaming services seem to be kind of topping out. And then other streaming services that are not Netflix have had problems monetizing their user base into something that is sustainable, at least as an alternative to the cable bundle, which used to just print money for these companies.
Yeah, I feel like this is a different conversation if you have it a year ago, 6 months ago, 2 years from now. This is constantly changing. What do you have your eye on in this glut of streaming options that are out there?
It really is always changing. And I think the current inflection point is that we were in this moment of huge expansion, right? There was like a year-long span where all of a sudden you had Disney Plus and Apple TV Plus and Peacock and Paramount Plus. And now we're getting into this moment where the expansion is petering out and we're heading into a moment of maybe austerity, maybe contraction. You're seeing all these cuts at Discovery or Warner Brothers Discovery. We're kind of heading into leaner years, which seems ironic because there's still never been more television to actually watch as a consumer.
What kind of strategies are these companies using now? Because I like on one hand, it could be like, okay, hey, subscribe to us. We got this deep catalog. You can watch stuff forever versus the killer app. Like we've got this one show that we want everybody to want to watch. That's going to get them to sign up for it. What's the balance of power between those two approaches?
I mean, I think companies are starting to understand that you can't just shackle your entire fate to one, you know, House of the Dragon, which is we entered into that, or Stranger Things. You need something all the time to keep people interested and to avoid, you know, the C word in streaming is churn, where people will subscribe just to check out House of the Dragon, and then they're going to pull out as soon as that's done. And I think these streaming services have to balance constantly investing in these big high profile releases that are going to draw people and then actually making the balance sheet make sense and keeping Wall Street happy. And I think a lot of these companies are getting kind of torn in several different directions. And that's why everyone seems so lost right now.
Allison Herman is with us, television and culture writer for The Ringer. We are looking at streaming video services. There are lots of them. Lots of people are watching them, but they aren't necessarily lucrative businesses. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you subscribed to one or two or five or 10 different streaming services? Are you overwhelmed by what's out there? Are you kind of like me and you're kind of retreating, paralyzed by the various options out there? 800-642-1234 with your own streaming experiences or lack of same or your questions. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Okay, Allison, you mentioned Warner Brothers and Discovery, which has something to do with HBO and the HBO Max streaming service. Something big happened, and I got to admit, I'm a little confused about what just happened. What just happened?
Well, first of all, it is confusing, and that is a completely understandable response to this.
Good.
So essentially what happened is that Warner Media used to be a company owned by AT&T, which never made a ton of sense. And so AT&T spun out Warner Media and merged it with Discovery, a company that is run by an executive named David Zaslav, who is now running the combined company called Warner Brothers Discovery. As a result of that merger, that company took on a ton of debt and now has to kind of even out its balance sheet going forward to appease its investors. People knew that and certainly knew that there would be cuts coming. You know, there are always redundancies when you merge companies of this size with relatively similar businesses. But what's really, really shocked people are some of the, some would call them creative, some would call them unduly harsh measures that have been taken. So for example, I think the one that really, really shocked people was that David Zaslav pulled the plug on Batgirl, a nearly complete $90 million movie that will now not only not be released in theaters, it's not even going to be released on streaming. And that is just such an unprecedented step. It's really sent shockwaves through the industry.
And another thing that I think struck people is they took a lot of their streaming catalog off, including a lot of kids-related shows. The HBO incarnation of Sesame Street stuff included in that, and Elmo. That said, Sopranos and Sesame Street always seemed like a weird combination for HBO.
It does, but then also, you know, Disney Plus is starting to experiment with having more adult content next to kids content. Netflix has Coco Melon, but also The Sandman. I think a lot of these companies are figuring out they need to be kind of four quadrant businesses. But with HBO and Discovery, David Zaslav has been saying, you know, we want to cut back on, for example, unscripted content on HBO Max because Discovery Plus is already so good at making reality. And so that's a larger strategic shift. But then I think something that, again, is really taking people aback is that completely unannounced, they've been just, or initially unannounced and then later they announced it, but it was still pretty abrupt. They've just been pulling entire catalogs of shows. And certain reporting has come out that says they're mostly doing that to really avoid paying residuals to the creators, which, again, is just really rubbing people the wrong way.
Bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jerry is with us in Onalaska. Jerry, hello.
Hi. I used to like Netflix a lot because I thought they had a lot of foreign films, and I really learned to like foreign films a lot. But now I can't seem to, they seem to specialize more in films that they make. And I am looking for a provider with more foreign films. I mean, lots of foreign films.
Oh,
who would that be?
Jerry, interesting question. Allison, anywhere you'd point Jerry?
Oh, yes. I would definitely recommend the Criterion Channel. It's definitely a smaller service, and it doesn't quite have, you know, the user interface that something like Netflix has. But if you're looking for more obscure, more art house, or foreign films, it's really an invaluable resource, and I use it a lot.
Thanks for that call, Jerry, at 800-642-1234. And Jerry mentioned, you know, a move, you know, it used to be, I thought of Netflix as they'd get whatever the content they could get their hands on, an 80s sitcom here, a movie from 10 years ago there, new stuff. And Jerry noticing that they're making more of their own stuff. Could you talk about that strategy consideration, not just for Netflix, but for a lot of these services?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a pretty shrewd observation. And part of it is just out of necessity, right? When Netflix was first becoming big, they had a lot of Marvel films and even Marvel original series that they made just as part of their catalog. And they kind of saw that as the streaming industry started to expand, a lot of these legacy media companies weren't going to want to just lease out their stuff so that other people could gain big platforms off of it. So speaking of Marvel, now you have Disney Plus, where Disney has its own in-house service and it doesn't need to, you know, tell its audience to go elsewhere. So it makes a lot of sense that all these companies are investing in original programming, but original programming is expensive, franchises are hard to build from the ground up, and quality is just really difficult. So it's a tough row to hoe.
Thanks again for that call. We're talking to TV writer Allison Herman from The Ringer about the rise of streaming video, the latest twists and turns in the industry, what the future could hold for streaming and for, you know, old-fashioned TV where you turn it on at a particular time. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you watch stuff on your TV? Do you watch a broadcast channel, a cable channel, streaming? How much streaming? How many different providers do you subscribe to at this point? Have you gone on a streaming subscription diet lately? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Allison Herman, TV and culture writer for The Ringer. With us today, looking at how streaming passed traditional TV and viewership, where it all might go from here. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. If you watch streaming TV, which platform do you prefer? Do you subscribe to lots or just one? Have you avoided the whole thing or maybe gotten back out of it? Cable subscription, still got it, gotten rid of it? What is your favorite show? What leads you to turn on the TV? Call 800-642-1234 with your own choices, your experiences, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. 1234. Allison, been focusing on streaming lately. If I have cable channels, if I have broadcast channels, what am I doing right now to try to, you know, keep people watching me?
Well, frankly, a lot of these companies are just committing to streaming whole hog. So you have Viacom CBS, which, or now Paramount Global, which owns a lot of these legacy networks, and they also own Paramount Plus. NBC Universal owns NBC, among other networks like Bravo, and they also own Peacock. And so a lot of these companies are in these really awkward balancing act of trying to stem the tide through their linear channels, but also just redirecting all their resources. So as part of the HBO Max Discovery drama that we were talking about earlier, David Zaslav recently kind of essentially ended the practice of original series scripted development at linear networks like TNT and TBS, and is essentially focusing all that creative energy on HBO Max, which makes sense as a long-term proposition, but obviously makes TNT and TBS less valuable in the short term. So it's a really difficult balance.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Tom joins us now in Racine. Tom, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I just appreciate the program today. And I wanted you to know I'm at the lake. I'm pretty much enjoying the lake by myself because I think people are home watching their streaming programs, which is kind of nice. I've never streamed. I wouldn't know how to, and I don't want to learn how. I'm trying to minimize, you know, things in my life, and that's one of those things I don't want to start doing now. But I appreciate your program, and I just wanted to say, and to a certain extent, it kind of ties in with a previous program where there was a on reading, where reading is fundamental, but it's also foundational, and we become people depending on the kinds of things we put into our minds. So I think it's really important that people be careful with what they watch on the streaming programs because
gotcha.
We're out here.
Tom, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for calling in. Allison, there are, of course, a lot of people out there who don't stream and people like Tom steering clear of TV altogether. I don't know. What do you think? Is it easy to get seduced into watching too much?
Oh, of course. I mean, the rise of streaming is synonymous with the rise of the binge watch. It didn't used to be so easy to just download, you know, 8 to 10 hours of content and just, you know, drink it all down in a single night. So I understand not wanting to give in to the temptation, but, you know, I am a television critic, so I will say there is a lot of worthwhile stuff to watch on streaming. Don't be too afraid of it. Just maybe just practice moderation.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Allison Herman from The Ringer about streaming getting bigger and bigger, more and more complicated. You could still join in with your own experiences at 800-642-1234. Allison, I may have asked you about this the last time you were on, but I always wonder with TV critics and all the stuff is out there, like it's impossible to watch all the stuff. How do you keep up?
I mean, frankly, it's triage, and part of it is just accepting the futility of the whole enterprise. I am not going to watch everything, nor would I be able to, nor would I even want to. But I do try. First of all, I keep a spreadsheet that helps me keep track of everything that I'm watching. And I just try to kind of keep in touch with what people are interested in. So this week it was pretty obvious because House of the Dragon's on HBO, and that's what people are watching.
What shows are you recommending now, regardless of platform?
Sure. So I actually just filed a piece that's going to run tomorrow about The Rehearsal, which is a show on HBO that is just incredibly ambitious and strange and genre-defying and really must be seen to be believed. So I would encourage people to check that out. And then I've just been watching screeners for a show called The Patient that stars Steve Carell and Domhnall Gleeson and will be airing on FX and Hulu from the creators of The Americans. And it is about a therapist who is abducted by a serial killer who hopes that the therapist will teach him how not to be a serial killer. So it's got a black comic vibe, and I've really enjoyed what I've seen so far.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. I haven't heard of that. Steve Carell, I thought comedy. Wait, serial killer abduction. Okay, black comedy, I kind of get that. Now, I've been wondering, there's some news out there that some companies are putting together streaming bundles, like we used to have cable bundles. I guess there's maybe a Hulu, Disney Plus, and ESPN Plus together. Is this a new trend we're going to see, taking all these different threads and bundling them together?
Well, the three services that you just mentioned are all owned by Disney. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of in Disney's interest to bundle them together and say, you know, you can get discounts on all three if you get all three. So we can count you as a subscriber to all three and tell that to our investors. But I think something that may happen in the future is that we do get something that's a little more similar to a cable bundle, where you get bundling of services that are owned by different companies. Netflix is obviously independent. Amazon has its own service. So does Apple, et cetera. And it's almost been a joke that people have been saying about streaming recently, but I do think there is some truth to it, is that we've almost innovated our way back into traditional cable television. So we don't have a bundle yet, but we do have a lot of services have recently announced, like Netflix, that they're adding an advertising tier. And that used to be a big differentiator of streaming from so-called regular television. And now it's the same.
Now, one of the big things keeping regular television and I think cable going is live sports. Yeah, you can go back and watch the big game later. I've done that, but it's not exactly the same. Are streaming services trying to figure out a way to capture live sporting events?
Absolutely. Amazon has Thursday Night Football, I believe. Apple is widely rumored to be in the running for NFL Sunday Ticket. And Peacock was originally planned to launch around the Olympics. Obviously, that didn't quite happen. But that's a big part of the value proposition for that service. And I think a lot of companies are really aware that sports are almost this final frontier of what streaming has not been able to crack. And so there's a lot of incentive for them to kind of wedge their way in, because sports have such an incredibly dedicated audience. They're kind of considered one of the final holdovers of true live linear TV viewing.
Let's go back to our callers. Cheryl is with us in Eau Claire. Cheryl, hi.
Hi. I'm sorry to see that soap operas are falling to the wayside. My favorite, Days of Our Lives, is leaving mainstream NBC, and you have to have Peacock now to watch it.
Interesting. Are you going to get Peacock to keep up with Days?
I just got a company putting cable down the ditch of my road. I live out in the country a little bit, so I'm just getting 5G. I don't know yet.
Okay. All right. Well, good luck. I hope you can keep up, Cheryl. Yeah, soap operas, I know they've been dropping over the years from networks. Do you think, Allison, they could survive on streaming platforms?
Maybe. I think for younger audiences, they've almost been supplanted by reality television. I think Real Housewives is the soap opera of my generation. But you are seeing a lot of these networks put, you know, content like soap operas, or, you know, what comes to mind is Disney Plus as Dancing with the Stars as opposed to ABC. So I think people have traditionally associated streaming with a certain audience and a certain kind of programming. And in an effort to kind of hasten that transition, a lot of these companies are taking soap operas, sports, any kind of things that you may think would be traditionally the province of regular TV, and saying, no, this can be for streaming, and we hope you'll join us in the future.
Thanks for that call, Cheryl. You mentioned younger audiences, Allison. And yeah, when you break down viewership numbers by demographics, what are we seeing with younger people when it comes to streaming versus other ways of watching?
Well, this is almost in the reverse, but a statistic that got a lot of play recently is that the CW network was just acquired by a buyer, and the buyer said, well, the average age of the CW viewer is actually 58, so we're going to program around that, which comes as a surprise, I think, to a lot of people who associate the CW with Riverdale, for example. But it didn't really surprise me, because the CW has had a long-time distribution deal with Netflix, which means that most of the people who were watching shows like Riverdale or any of the DC shows or something like Jane the Virgin were younger people. They just weren't watching it on the CW. So I think it's less that streaming is still the province of young people, although I think people my age really just have, we don't even cut the cord. We've never had the cord to begin with. But older audiences are still very much on, or I should say, linear networks skew older in their audiences.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Allison, what is the next shoe you're waiting for to drop in the streaming wars?
You know, I think we're going to see at least one major service throw in the towel. I don't know which one it's going to be. I don't know when it's going to happen, but I don't think we can sustain this level of all these separate services duking it out for the same slice of pie too much longer.
Allison, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Allison Herman, staff writer for The Ringer, where she writes about television and culture. She is with us today for a look at the rise of streaming TV services. Looking for some follow-up from you, you can email ideas@WPR.org. What show are you watching now, and how are you watching it? Again, email ideas@WPR.org with your current TV show recommendation, current or past. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, he was a Wisconsin legend and a towering figure in the history of baseball. Meet the real Hank Aaron with the author of a book by that name. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Wisconsin has another claim to fame this week, with the state capturing not one but two national championships for the kids with the best mullets. Yes, the haircut from the 1980s, mostly short in the front, long in the back. There is a national mullet competition, and Wisconsin youth had a strong showing at the finals over the weekend. An 8-year-old from Menominee won the kids division, and a teenager from Wausau picked up the top prize in the teen bracket. I looked into the history of the mullet on the Mullet Championship website. There were some pre-80s versions, but the haircut reached its peak in the 1980s. And like many things from pop culture back then, it seems to be making a comeback. Ironic? Sincere? Who can say these days? We can all just mullet over. Sorry. Style news you can use. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a look at birds. We'll meet a Wisconsin birding enthusiast who's working to get more people of color into the outdoor hobby. Plus, he'll share a couple of rare sightings just from the last week. Now, not too many people choose to get up close and personal with sharks, especially those of us growing up in Wisconsin, hundreds of miles from the nearest ocean. That didn't stop our next guest from following her fascination for fins all the way down to the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology Shark Lab, where she works literally hands-on with sharks of all shapes and sizes. Kaylee Rossing is a graduate student researcher at the University of Hawaii. She was part of a research team featured on the National Geographic show Maui Shark Mystery on Disney+. She's originally from Janesville. I talked to Kaylee last week from the island of Oahu. All right, first I gotta ask, you grew up in Wisconsin, how did you end up interested in studying sharks?
I get that question a lot. Of course, it all started when I was probably around 10 years old. I took my first trip to the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago. And, you know, after that, I, of course, was super interested, you know, just in a broad overview, you know, the ocean in its entirety. And it wasn't until high school that I actually started getting more and more interested specifically into sharks. So, yeah, since high school.
Now, there's some people out there who will think shark equals scary. Can you let us know why we should be thinking maybe shark equals fascinating?
Yeah, no, I mean, they're incredible creatures. I mean, I don't want to tell people how to feel about, you know, one thing or another, but they're definitely animals to be respected, and they are capable, just like any other wild animal, of, you know, causing harm to, you know, you, me, or other animals, but they really are just big fish, you know. They're swimming around doing their own thing. They're looking for food. It's, yeah, being able to, you know, experience them up close has really shown me how wonderful they are and how unique they are. I get to, you know, hang around with multiple different species, and they're so neat. I really, you know, I'm bursting at the seams trying to, you know, keep my calm here.
Now let's get into some of the work that you do with your colleagues at the lab. First of all, one of the things you do is tag and track sharks. Can you talk about the process of tagging them and then what we learned from that?
So my lab, yeah, is known for not only tagging, but tracking sharks around the islands of Hawaii. And yeah, the process of that is, of course, I'll make it super simplified, but we have a long line. So it starts with a buoy, drops down to an anchor, and that sits at the bottom of the ocean. And then we have a main line that has some hooks with bait on it, and then another anchor and then a buoy. So it kind of does like a U shape. But of course, from the top side, we only see the buoys. And if we have a shark on the line, we usually bring it close to the boat. We keep the sharks in water just because of their body structure. And, you know, any taking them out of the water puts any extra stress on them with gravity and whatnot. So we keep them over the side of the boat. And there's a wide variety of things we do, but we normally start with measurements. We measure from, you know, the tip of the nose all the way down to its tail. We try and get what is known as like the total length. And that way we have it documented. We know how big the shark is. So we're mostly known for our acoustic tags, and that's actually a little implant. So we have the acoustic tag, which is no bigger than, say, like a chapstick. And we make a small incision on their tummy, and we pop the acoustic tag in. We suture it shut, and they are good to go. That will forever, until that little battery dies, ping off a location in a sorts. And then we have receivers around Oahu in the ocean that will then pick up that detection from that acoustic tag. And yeah, from that, we're able to track them all around the Hawaiian Islands. We have acoustic receivers out, you know, around all of the islands. So it's really exciting to then go pick up those receivers, download that data, and just see where those sharks have been moving.
Talking to Kaylee Rossing, originally from Janesville, now doing shark research in Hawaii. Kaylee, you mentioned different kinds of measurements. Another measurement you do is shark bite impressions to get an estimate of the size of sharks. How do you measure that?
Yeah, so that was actually part of my undergraduate research. I was super fortunate to talk to my now advisor, Carl Meyer, and he came up with that idea, and I just kind of went full force into it. So it's a very similar process. It's taking that shark, tagging it, and right before we let it go, I have segments of surfboards. And what I do is I try and get that surfboard into the shark's mouth and have them make an impression. Now, of course, that sounds funny. And for people who don't know, I'm not teaching them to bite surfboards.
Right.
They don't, you know, they don't do that. But all I'm trying to do is get a bite impression. And as odd as it sounds, it is more difficult than it looks. You know, sometimes sharks don't want to bite stuff. And so, but yeah, sometimes if we have like a little feistier one, it gives me a good impression. And basically what I'm looking at is that curve of that bite. So I specifically work with tiger sharks, and they have a quite semicircular bite. And for that, it's super simple. We have that total length, and then I do some math and put that against the measured curve of that bite. And from that, I can actually tell within about 10 to 15 centimeters, it's accurate total length. And the reason behind this was because the Division of Aquatic Resources out here has a incidence list. So it's all accounts of, you know, human shark interactions that have been recorded, and it gives you a bunch of information, but one of the columns is length. And these are, of course, you know, witness accounts. So of course, if you're in that moment, maybe the shark was a little bigger than what you expected, or, you know, how accurate is that information truly? And so, you know, there's a huge difference between a 5-foot shark and an 8-foot shark. And so what I wanted to do was to, you know, be able to give the public better, more accurate information. And the first question anybody ever asks after, you know, there is a bite, say on a surfboard or, you know, stand-up paddleboard, you know, the first question is, how big was the shark? And yeah, now the Division of Aquatic Resources, first responders have that technique that either they're able to do, or they're able to send us a photo and I can help give them the accurate total length.
And speaking of bite prints, you're also looking for DNA, figuring out how to get shark DNA, I guess, from bites?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, that first step was getting those bite impressions and seeing if that was, you know, an accurate way about doing it. And then I was able to collaborate with another lab at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology, and specifically with another graduate student, Derek Kraft. And he has since, you know, been able to take those bite impressions and swab them for DNA. So we basically, we do have the surfboard, we put it in the shark's mouth, And then we would dunk it, you know, a handful of times simply to replicate, you know, a surfer coming back in, say, if they did get their board bitten or something of that sort, whether it just gets washed up on shore. So we try and do our best to replicate, you know, what it would be like in a real life situation. And he was able to retrieve DNA off of these bites that we were getting. And from that, we now have DNA swab kits on Oahu and on Maui that are readily available for first responders if that ever does happen.
In just our last few moments, you know, you, as you mentioned, your career was sparked by a visit to Shedd Aquarium. Could you make the case for, you know, parents to expose their kids to cool things in the world of science world, aquatic or otherwise?
Yeah, absolutely. I am, you know, a huge nerd at heart, and I absolutely love, you know, the Shedd Aquarium was, you know, right up my alley from day one. But I truly just encourage everyone to, you know, go out and see things. You know, I didn't get a lot of opportunities to travel when I was younger. So, you know, I was very landlocked, but yet here I am now in the middle of the Pacific Ocean studying sharks. But yeah, I mean, you know, I had a really great close professor of mine once, you know, just encouraged me to, you know, do what scares you. And of course she was like, not in the literal sense, but do something that excites you. And, you know, I just remember looking back as, you know, at myself as a little girl, like watching Shark Week or, you know, Nat Geo or Discovery or something like that. And it's just, yeah, it's truly amazing to now be in this place in my life where I get to work with these animals day in and day out.
Kaylee, thanks again for joining
us. Go to the Shedd Aquarium.
Thanks again for joining us. That's Kaylee Rossing, originally from Janesville, now a graduate student researcher in the Shark Lab at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology at the University of Hawaii. She joined us for a look at her work with sharks. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about reading to children.
A mother's voice can wrap us in warm blankets. It can guide gently or yank us back from the cliff. And sometimes it can take us places we only dreamed were possible. Jan Larson and her three grown children remember a mother's voice.
Our children are grown. The magic is packed in cardboard boxes and tucked away in the loft, waiting for the next generation to reveal its secrets. The snuggler, an oversized chair that once cradled the Larsons five each night before sleep claimed our three young ones, sits empty in the corner of our living room. But once upon a time, those twilight hours held the promise of adventure, of magic, of silly laughter, as my husband and I beckoned our pajama-clad pirates to join us in the joy of reading. And when the clamor for, "Just one more, Mommy," rang out, I didn't mind a bit.
Dina, what do you remember about being read to as a child?
You did voices, and now whenever I read to friends or loved ones, I do voices. And it makes all the difference. It's even more immersive. And it's funny because just like I associate certain characters in some of my favorite stories from my childhood with you, some of the favorite characters in stories that I've shared with friends or loved ones since then are now associated with my voice and my mannerisms.
Gray, what are you thinking about? How did reading make you feel?
I just wanted to speak to what Dana said, because Dana and I read together, and I read sometimes, but most often I like when Dana reads because he's better at the voices.
Ellie, what do you remember about the Larsons Five reading together at night?
We were living on our sailboat together and found a copy of the seventh Harry Potter book. And by that time, two of us were teenagers already, but we still loved having you read to us. And we made you read that book for hours on end because we were so desperate to hear more of this story. And I couldn't get our hands on enough copies for all of us to have separately. And I remember you begging us to let you take a break so that you could get food and some water.
Yes, I remember that very well. And then what did you do that night after I'd gone to bed? Because I went to bed with the book and hid it under my pillow.
Well, your point was to make it fair so that nobody could read ahead, but I snuck it out from under your pillow and stayed up all night reading it.
I distinctly remember being at the end of A Chain of Theft. Ellie would steal the book from Mom and read it, and then Gray would procure the book from Ellie and read it. And the whole time that they were reading it would be pouting at them disapprovingly, saying, "You're not supposed to be reading ahead, okay? This is for Mom to read."
What he meant was, we weren't supposed to be reading ahead of Dana.
Yeah, not without me.
Do you think ahead to maybe having your own families and what you'll do then?
Yes, bring them over so that you can read to them too.
I'll be happy to. I will be happy to. And then it will be a grandmother's voice. That will be a fun thing.
Well, you're going to have to wait a while for that. That's not coming anytime soon.
That's okay. That'll be worth the wait. Thanks so much. It is always a pleasure to get to read to you, and I hope that you have good memories of feeling warm and loved.
We always do.
They're all of the best memories.
You gave us all the good things that we have.
Oh, I love you, kids.
Love you, Mom.
We love you, Mom.
Aren't you going to say your signature line?
Oh. Thanks for making us.
And they all lived happily in harmony and peace ever after. Writer Jan Larson is the chair of the Communication and Journalism Department at UW-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we'll check out a Wisconsin effort to connect people through a love of birding. That's next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, from woodpeckers and robins to more uncommon sightings, our next guest is birding his way through Wisconsin and creating community around the hobby while he does it. He's supporting an inclusive community of people of color to share their passions of the outdoors and of birds. Dexter Patterson is co-founder of the BIPOC Birding Club of Wisconsin and a faculty associate in the College of Life Science Communication at UW-Madison. Dexter, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the club, let's check out your latest sighting over the weekend, snowy owl in a grocery store parking lot.
How crazy is that, right?
Yeah.
It's so funny because this weekend was my birthday. So I like to say that it came to pay me a visit on my birthday, but my mom actually is the one that spotted it. She got off work and she's going to Woodman's gas station in Sun Prairie to get gas. And she sees a snowy owl sitting on the light pole right by the gas station. And she calls me just freaking out, right? I mean, like, I call it bird joy, but she was just freaking out. She's like, "Oh my God, Dex, I think I see a snowy owl," but she's like, "It's August. I don't know if it's really a snowy owl." So, you know, my Wisco birder radar went off and I was like, "I will be there in a minute," because I live in Sun Prairie. And sure enough, I pull up and there's a male snowy owl just staring down from the light pole.
Now, I hear the joy there, and happy birthday, by the way. What inspired you to start this BIPOC Birding Club of Wisconsin?
Honestly, it's just the lack of diversity that we were seeing in the birding community all across Wisconsin. My co-founder and I, Dr. Jeff Galligan, are both Black birders, both Black men. And we just saw a desire to just, you know, we had this desire to create these opportunities, not only for people of color, but for allies that share our mission to make the birding community more inclusive, more welcoming for everybody. I mean, this is across ages and everything. I think a lot of these traditional birding spaces are typically viewed for like older white people. And I just think that that's just a misconception that we want people to understand that birding is for everyone, even everybody listening to this program.
What's the response been like so far to the club?
Oh, it's been mind-blowing, to tell you the truth, that just how it's taken off. I mean, we held our first event just a little over a year ago on July 24th, 2021. And that event alone, we didn't know what to expect, but we had 15 birders come out, right? So, like, I was talking to Jeff, and I'm like, man, it might end up being me, you, and my kids, right? Like, I didn't know what to expect, but 15 birders showed up at our first event. And now we average anywhere from 30 to 40 birders at every event. And we've had up to 100
wow.
people on that event. This year, actually at Henry Vilas Zoo, we partnered with the zoo this year during Black Birders Week, and we had 100 birders come out from all over the state to enjoy not only the zoo, but people don't realize that there are wild birds as well that flock to the zoos because of like a lot of the old growth trees and the habitats that they provide. So you see a lot of wild birds at the local zoo as well.
All right. Snowy owl is cool, but here's a listen to something even more rare in Wisconsin. This comes from the Cornell Ornithology Lab. All right, that's the sound of a brown booby, and you saw one in Wisconsin, and that is yes. Unheard of, right? Share that bird joy with us.
I mean, what's crazy, and I got to give a huge shout out to our Milwaukee club leader, Rita Flores-Wiskowski. She sent me a text message, and she's like, Dexter, there's a report of a brown booby in La Crosse. And I'm like, what? I'm like, this is a pan-tropical seabird. Like, what the heck is it doing in Wisconsin? Like, up in La Crosse of all places. And she's like, I don't know, but there's a report of it. And I jumped in my car right away to go see it because this is the first ever recorded sighting of a brown booby in our state. So this was a once in a lifetime opportunity. And as a bird nerd, there was no way I was missing out on that opportunity.
And you found it. I saw some video. You tried to keep a nice distance, respectful distance. The brown booby didn't want any of that. It like flew right over you, right?
Yeah, it was definitely checking me out. But what's funny about the brown booby is I'm out on a kayak and I'm watching it from a very far distance. You know, I have good equipment, so I wasn't worried about it. I can zoom in just fine. And get good video footage or photos or whatever it might be. But like, I saw speedboats flying by it and it's just sitting there. Like, it's just chilling. I'm like, this bird is crazy. But what people don't remember is it got its name from Spanish explorers because the bird would just land on their ships and it never feared humans. So they would call it a bobo, AKA a stupid bird, which is kind of sad because it's so beautiful. But like, so many people just thought that like this bird is worried about humans or anything, but it really isn't. They actually have a reputation of not being afraid of humans or boats.
In our last just half a minute or so, Dexter, if somebody's out there thinking, yeah, birds are cool, but you know, birding isn't for me. I'm not a birding kind of person. What do you say to them?
I tell them birding is for everyone. You don't need to have a camera. You don't need to have the fancy equipment. I just challenge you to pay attention. Pay attention to what you see in your backyard and your front yard and your neighborhood when you're on your walks. Just start to pay attention because I promise you, you never know what you might see. Heck, you might even see a snowy owl sitting on a light pole.
Dexter, thanks so much for joining us and sharing this with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Dexter Patterson, co-founder of the BIPOC Birding Club of Wisconsin. He joined us to talk about his love of birding and the club he's created to bring people together and expand birding into groups of people who might not think of themselves as birders. Hey, do you have a rare sighting? Maybe not as rare as that one you want to share with us? You can email. Photos are great, but you can just tell us about it too. Email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org. If you've got a bird sighting in your neck of the woods, love to hear about it. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we humans have dreams, for better or worse. Do dogs or cats or all those other species out there? Find out with the author of the new book, When Animals Dream, The Hidden World of Animal Consciousness. Find out what's going on in your pet's minds when they're sleeping. And we'll find out what makes a great protest song, plus a look at the effort to legalize marijuana in states around the country and the latest polling data here in Wisconsin. That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.